anything to do with anything I want to talk about. But hopefully, you know, someone once said, no one listens to the first 5 minutes of your sermon anyway. So hopefully that gives you a chance to settle in and hear what I actually want to say. In season 4, episode 7 of one of my favorite TV shows, Mad Men, it's called The Suitcase because the entire episode revolves around this ad campaign that they're doing for Samsonite luggage. And if you don't know about Mad Men, it's a show about ad executives on Madison Avenue in the late 1950s, early 1960s. It's one of my favorite shows, one of our favorite shows. As I've said, you know, if you're going to come to St. Paul's, you have to watch everything Pixar ever did. You have to watch Mad Men and Friday Night Lights and Battlestar Galactica. And if not, just leave now because you're not going to understand anything I ever say. But it's this amazing episode in which it basically centers around a day in the life of two of the main characters. Don Draper, who is sort of the main character. He's sort of the Ubermensch, the Superman of the series, the incredible ad man who at the same time has this dark, secret life that he doesn't want anyone to find out about. He's very literally living at least two lives, probably more like three or four. And then this other sort of young copywriter named Peggy. And the entire the day centers around the fact that Don has this sort of other, you know, he's living in New York City, but he kind of has this other family out in California. And this woman who he loves deeply, but who's not actually his wife, who's dying of cancer. And he gets this phone call, he gets a message to his office saying, you know, call California immediately, it's urgent. And he just knows that he's going to call and find out that this person is dying and maybe even dead. And so over the course of this day, which starts in one morning and ends up on the next morning and sort of goes all through the night, he is doing everything he possibly can to avoid making this phone call, to avoid facing the darkness of the death of this person who is so close to him. And so what he does is he sort of takes it out on this copywriter, Peggy, who is supposed to be at a birthday dinner with her fiancé and her mother, and she keeps on calling her fiancé and saying, I'm going to be later, 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 until he finally cancels. She cancels on him, and it's not good. But, you know, Don makes Peggy stay there all night to help him, ostensibly with the Samsonite thing, but all that's really happening is that Don is just getting drunker and drunker and drunker because he doesn't want to make this phone call. And it ends up, they end up sort of falling asleep on the couch in his office. Nothing, you know, nothing untoward happens at all between them. But they fall asleep, and then he wakes up, and it's the morning. It's got to be early morning, like, you know, 6 a.m., the sun's just coming up. And he finally goes, and he makes the phone call he's been dreading to make. And he gets someone on the other line, and the person just says, she's gone. And he says, you know, was she asking for me? And the woman says, well, she wasn't really there at the end. She didn't really know what was going on. But she's in a better place now. And Don, fighting back tears, says, well, you know, that's what they say. Because Don doesn't believe, you know, he doesn't believe anything. He's a hopeless, and when I say hopeless, I mean he has no hope, sort of nihilist, basically. And then he hangs up the phone, and he just loses it. He just starts weeping. And John Hamm is an amazing actor, and I defy you to watch this Suitcase episode, season 4, episode 7, and not lose it. Like, I've watched about 3 times over the past couple days, and every time that scene comes, it's just like I well up. It's powerful. And Peggy is just waking up, and she looks over him, and she says, what's wrong? Because she's never seen him like this. Don never does this. He never falls apart, even though his life is a total disaster. He always keeps it together, but he's, you know, he's exhausted, and he's hungover, and it's just too much for him. And he says, I just lost someone very important to me. And she says, who? And he says, the only person in the world who really knew me. And she walks up, and she puts his hand on his back, and she says, that's not true. And it blows you away. It's powerful. And the reason that Peggy can do that Peggy is the voice of comfort in Don's life, is because she has been through her own incredibly dark times as well. You know, a couple seasons previously, she had a one-night stand with a fellow co-worker in the office with whom she still works. She actually got pregnant nobody knew, she didn't even actually know, is one of those incredible situations where, you know, you don't know you're pregnant until you're like 8. You should have kept on gaining weight. You didn't know why, which this does actually happen. I was listening to a This American Life episode that's another thing you have to listen to, where they interviewed women to whom this had happened. Like, how could this possibly happen? But it happens. These people aren't crazy. They're not delusional. They're not in denial. People actually get pregnant and don't know they're pregnant. So she goes to the doctor and finds out she's pregnant and has the baby and won't even look at the baby, but gives it up for adoption. And then we see that somehow Don is found out. And Don is in the doctor's office with her. And he's the only one who knows about this deep, deep, deep pain in Peggy's life. And it's because of this pain that Peggy has that she's able to recognize and commiserate and comfort a fellow sufferer. She's able to say to Don, you know, that's not true. I know you. You know, I don't know every part of your life, but I know you. I know where you are right now. I know who you are. I know what you're going through. And it's just this unbelievable moment of connection between two broken, suffering people. On to the next thing. A couple weeks ago, there was a pretty amazing article in The New Yorker about sort of Hollywood's therapist, a man named Barry Michaels, therapist to the stars. You know, he charges something like $400 an hour. They don't give you any specific names, of course, but they mention, you know, writers who have won Oscars for their screenplays and top agents and actors, and he's sort of like, he is the guy to go to in Hollywood. And the amazing thing about reading this article is it was just totally clear that, you know, this guy is not, he's not remotely Christian in the sort of, you know, worldly sense, but he's deeply Christian in the sense that he understands people. And he understands a judgment, he understands condemnation, he understands how when you feel judged, when you fear being judged, you can do nothing, you can't create. You know, if anyone here is an artist, you know that any sort of, you know, judgment you feel from outside or inside completely destroys creativity. So he'll work with these writers who have been blocked for like 2 years because they're scared to sit down and write anything because they just know it's going to be terrible and they hate themselves. And he gives them little mantras. And one of his mantras are, I love this, you are marked to battle the forces of judgment. And he tells them to repeat that. You are marked to battle the forces of judgment. Or another one of the thing he tells writers specifically is, and he doesn't use this word, he uses the S word, but I'm not going to use the S word. Keep writing poo, stupid. In other words, just sit down and do it, and you can't control it, and wait for inspiration to come. You can't control inspiration. Most of what you write is going to be total crap. But then inspiration is going to hit, and you know, describing this one writer who had been blocked for 2 years, who then comes to this guy, gets some therapy, sits down. 3 weeks later, he's got the screenplay, and he wins an Oscar for it, like 6 months later. So this man understands people. He understands judgment. And he just, you know, I mean, listen to this. This is another amazing thing. He talks about this part that Michaels is part of a personality or this person type where he calls it the part X. And here's how he describes part X. A deeply primitive dimension of the personality he identified after he began to work with show business patients. Its characteristics are petulance, rage, arrogance, hypersensitivity, a sense of victimization, and above all, a resistance to process. In other words, you want control. You can't sort of let it play out. It's got to happen now, right now. Michaels explains by invoking the behavior of a 2-year-old, which I can relate to this because I look in the mirror. It's the part that's pounding. It's the part that's pounding on the table because nothing's good enough, he says. They're saying no to everything, even the color of the sippy cup. Unacceptable. Most of us, I'm not sure this is actually true, but he thinks it's true. Most of us grow beyond the expectation that life will meet our needs in every instance. Some don't. That's the head of the studio, the head of the agency or whatever, pounding his fist on a table and saying, damn it, somebody's going to pay for it. It's the part of the ego that is so egotistical it believes it's God, king of the universe. You know, I'm the king of the world. That guy's, you know, Cameron, my goodness. At every moment, the universe is telling him, sorry, bub, you're not God. And he's screaming, no, you're wrong, and I'm going to prove it to you. That sound familiar? It does to me. But again, that's not actually what I want to talk about. Here's what I really want to get to. I just want to set him up as someone you might actually want to listen to, because he's a Hollywood therapist, and in my mind, that immediately sets him up as a total buffoon, probably. But of course, good things come out of Hollywood even. At the center of Michael's practice is the Jungian, Carl Jung, figure of the shadow. The occult aspect of the personality that Jung defined as, quote, the sum of all those unpleasant qualities we like to hide, together with the insufficiently developed functions and the contents of the personal unconscious. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung describes a dream in which he was out on a windy night, cupping a tiny candle in his hand. I looked back and saw a gigantic black figure following me, he writes. When I awoke, I realized at once that the figure was a, quote, specter of the Brocken, my own shadow on the swirling mists brought into being by the little light I was carrying. As the liaison to the unconscious, Michael says, the shadow, listen to this, the shadow is the source of all creativity and agility in life, business, and art, which he calls flow. Quote, if you can really know your own shadow, you start to know the shadows of everyone, he says. People who can write that way start to articulate universal themes, which not only makes them more successful on that level, in other words, commercially, but it's a more gratifying endeavor. If you can connect to the shadow, you can connect to the universal narrative, to the collective unconscious, to, and we just know that's true, right? What are the movies you love? They're the movies that touch your pain in some way, that speak to your unfulfilled longings, your unfulfilled dreams, or your brokenness, your suffering. And this is actually what today's readings are about. Because in today's reading, God sends Samuel on a mission to go find a new king. Saul has been deposed. It's time for a new king. Samuel's really torn up about it. He really liked Saul for some reason. But God says, go to Bethlehem, go to Jesse the Bethlehemite, and one of his sons is going to be your next king, and I'm going to show you which one it is. So he goes to Bethlehem, and he finds Jesse, and one by one, Jesse brings out his son, starting with the oldest first. And what does it say? Samuel sees his first son. When they came, he looked on Eliab, the first, the oldest, the most polished. He's got to be the overachiever, right? How many of you are first children? Don't answer that question. I am. Got to be the best. And says to himself, surely the Lord's anointed is now before the Lord. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord does not see as mortals see. They look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And then Jesse brings out his second son, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, finally. And he says, that's all the sons I got. And God says, that's none of these guys. And Samuel says, you got any more sons? And Jesus says, oh yeah, there's the youngest, kind of worthless one, the one I'd rather not talk about, the one I kind of want to hide. He's out tending the sheep. And I got to say, I sort of understood this better when I went to Ethiopia 10 years ago. Or in retrospect, I understand better thinking about my time there. Because there were these big families, and what would be striking is that the older the children got, the better dressed they got. So the older children would be wearing something resembling, like normal, what we would consider clothing. And it wasn't warm. We were up in the highlands. It was like 45, 50 degrees. And actually sort of cloudy a lot of the time, surprisingly. And then the youngest ones would be in like a ripped t-shirt and no shoes. And I said, why are the youngest ones, like the most vulnerable, why do they have no clothes? And my friend who was working there said, well, families want to kind of make sure that the kids are going to make it before they invest in them. And so they would send the youngest kids out to watch the sheep. That's why David was out watching the sheep. He was the youngest. He was the least worthwhile, the most worthless. But Jesse goes and brings him, and Samuel looks at him, and God says, this is the one I want. This is my guy. This is the king. And we need to be careful here, because what we might be tempted to say, it actually does say that he was, ruddy. I'm not quite sure what that means. Like, red? I don't know. Anyway, he was ruddy. He was attractive. He was good to look at. But remember, we found out before, God looks on the heart. And what do you think he saw? Because remember, this is the same guy. He's going to become king. And then he's going to go out, you know, on his porch one day and see some, you know, fine young thing down there washing herself and say, bring her over here and impregnate her and then have her husband killed. That's Bathsheba, the Bathsheba story. So when God looks on his heart, we're like, oh, David, he must have been so amazing. And there were amazing things about him. But, you know, like Mark Galley told us this past week, God tends to have really bad taste in who he chooses. I mean, you know, just look at, well, I won't say it. I was going to say look at your neighbor. But I won't say that because you're also devastatingly attractive. But God says this is the one, and it's this little boy. It's this little weak, sort of, but also sort of arrogant and cocky kid who goes out and slays the giant, who slays Jerusalem. Slays Goliath, the Philistine. This is the one that God is going to use to sort of make Israel strong. He's going to take the weak thing and give Israel victory through the weak thing, the thing that's cast out, the thing that's forgotten about, the thing that's put out to pasture. And if you look in the Bible, God does this over and over and over and over again. You know, he does it with Jacob and Esau. Remember, Esau was the older. He was the honest. He was the good. He was his father's favorite. And Jacob was the swindler, the cheat. But it's Jacob who gets the blessing. And you know, it's not Abraham, Isaac, and Esau. It's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Or I think about Joseph, you know, the youngest of the 12 sons, also like really kind of cocky and arrogant, and you know, having these dreams about his brothers bowing down to him, which, you know, as an oldest, I can imagine. But youngest should be saying stuff like that. And so they take him and they throw him into the pit and they tell his father that he's dead. And then he gets rescued into slavery and he goes into the jail and he becomes the, you know, the guy over all Egypt and saves Israel, right? The youngest, the weakest, the kid you throw away. You know, Paul comments on this in Romans and he says, you know, God sort of chooses Jacob over Esau so that it's not by man's power, it's not by the way that we would do things, but it's according to God's promise. It's according to God's grace. It's according to what God does. God chooses the weak to shame the strong. He chooses the foolish to shame the wise. He chooses the things that are not to shame the things that are. This is the way God works. And Paul sees it in his own life even. You know, how he's like, God, why am I so weak? Why am I so broken? Why am I under such affliction all the time and such suffering? And, you know, God says to him, my grace is sufficient for you. In your weakness, my power is made perfect. Or, you know, Paul says, we have this treasure in jars of clay so that it will be seen that this all-surpassing power comes from God and not from us. That God works in the midst of weakness. And we see that in today's gospel, that God chooses the blind, not the seeing, both, you know, literally and metaphorically. He chooses the blind, probably illiterate beggar. He doesn't choose the seeing wise scribes and Pharisees. And why? Well, Jesus says, you know, why was this man born blind? Was it his fault or his parents' fault? And Jesus says, neither. This man was born blind in order that God's glory might be revealed through him. So what does that mean? What does it mean that God's glory is going to be revealed through him? Does it mean that God is going to heal him and sort of demonstrate a miracle? Well, yes. You know, in this story at least, that's what happens, right? God's glory is revealed in the man's healing. But more than that, you know, when God acts to heal you, you know, either to heal you or through you as a broken, sinful vessel, there will be no doubt about who has done it. There will be no, I have made myself see. No, wrong. You know, I mean, of course we do this, you know, but when the gift comes, when the miracle happens, again, either to heal you or through you as an unhealed person, as a broken person, you have to throw up your hands and say, just praise God, you did it. I didn't do it. But that's not even primarily what I want us to see, or what I primarily want us to see, and this is why I talked about Mad Men, and this is why I talked about the Hollywood therapist, is that in God's eyes, and actually in reality, your wound is your strength. Your wound is your power. It's the part of you through which and in which God is working right now, your wound, and will most powerfully work in the future. He is at work in you. He is at work through you. He will continue to be at work through you, not in your strength, not in your gifts, and your, you know, that's all, that's good stuff too. And he does some good stuff through that too, but that's not where he works primarily. He primarily works through your wound, through the part of yourself that you want to send out to pasture and forget about forever. The place you want to keep hidden, like Michaels talks about. It's not your best he's going to use. It's your worst. Your pain, your fear, your sin, your shame, your vulnerability. You know, because when the way we think about it, when we meet someone or we want to impress them or we want to get in a relationship with them, or we want to tackle a problem or we want to get a job or anything, what we think is, you know, I have to bring out my best first. I'll bring out my big guns, my first son, you know, my whatever, my good looks, my rapier wit, my, whatever it is. Though I'm going to bring that out first, my big guns. And if that doesn't work, then I'll go to plan B and C and D and E and F. And God says, no, I'm going to use the David part of your life. That's your strength. The part that you don't want to talk about. You know this if you've ever been married or had like a really close friend. You know, those relationships may start out being about your strength, your attractiveness, your, you know, sort of what you have to offer. But if they're going to get to become a real relationship, a real bond, it's going to have to be about your brokenness. It's going to have to be about your woundedness. It's going to have to be about two wounded people seeing each other and saying to each other, I see you. I have mercy on you. I love you. I know you because I know myself. That's what real friendship is. Or another example, you know, when the chips are really down, when you're in a crisis, when, you know, when you're weary, feeling small. Seriously, are you going to go to the answer man? You're going to go to the guy who has it all together? The person who can give you the good advice? I mean, maybe you will, and it'll be a mistake. But the person you really want to go to is the broken person, is the person who's been through pain, the person who will see you and will say, you know, when you say, you know, no one in the world knows me, they'll say, that's not true. And they will listen to you. They won't try to fix you. They won't judge you. They'll just be there to mediate God's mercy and grace to you. Thornton Wilder, in a play called The Angel That Troubled the Waters, which is actually about, it's about the beggar who didn't get healed, being like, what the hell? And an angel comes down to him, which, you know, that's the legitimate response. An angel comes down to him and says, Thornton Wilder says the most profound thing. He says, in love's service, only wounded soldiers can serve. In love's service, only wounded soldiers can serve. And you look at Jesus, whom Isaiah called a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. You look at him and you think, you know, maybe a man like that, maybe a God like that, maybe he will see me. Maybe he can have compassion and mercy and grief on my own sorrows, on my own grief. And I think that this is actually what Jesus means when he says, the reason that this man was born blind, the reason why this person has this pain, this shame, this guilt, this sin, whatever it is so that God's glory could be made manifest in his life. I think that's what he means, is because when we live, when we sort of get in tune with that shadow, with that place of pain, and we see Jesus seeing us, and we see him have mercy on it and wash it clean and love us in the midst of it. When you have a moment like the Peggy and Don moment, you know, where she's essentially saying, I love you, I see you, I'm with you. That is the moment at which God's glory, God's true but sort of quiet glory, is revealed to us, in us, through us, in the form of love, in the form of compassion. And when you, you know, when that happens, by the awful mercy of God, you become like this beacon of hope. You know, when you carry those, when you carry those sort of beloved wounds, people see it and they come to you and they want to talk to you. You become a safe person. You ever heard that before? He's a safe person. She's a safe person. And so in those moments when you are saying to God, why did you make me this way? Why are you not healing us? Why did this happen? Why is this happening? Why can't I control this? I want you to, I think what he wants to say to us and to me is, in order that my glory might be revealed in your life. That's why. And again, that's what Peggy understands and these Hollywood writers are coming to understand, and that's what David is about, that's what Jesus knows, that's what Paul knows, that's what the blind man is about. Your wound is your strength. In love's service, in God's service, in truth's service, compassion, mercy, grace's service, only wounded soldiers can serve. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you that that you see us, that you want to use the blind man parts of us, the David parts of us, the hurt parts of us to minister to a broken, suffering world. And I pray that you would do that, and I pray that you would, in this church, you would truly help us to see one another even as we are seen by you. I pray all these things in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.